You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
In his most recent book in defense of food, An Eater's Manifesto, Michael Pollan has some simple advice on what we should eat. Food, but not too much of it, and mostly plants. He was a guest on the show earlier this year, and we're going to air it again for you today. I began by asking him if this new book was a logical follow-up to his earlier bestseller, Omnivore's Dilemma.
What I was hearing from my readers who, would read the book and tell me they were actually afraid to finish it because every time they turned the page, there was something else they were afraid to eat. And I was afraid my readers would die on me, which is not what you want to happen if you're going to build a career as a writer.
So if you tell them what not to eat, then somewhere along the line you have to tell them what they can eat.
You want to offer some hope and sense of possibility. And in fact, my reaction to learning about the American food system was I saw things I didn't want to eat. I was on feedlots and confinement hog operations, and that does put you off your feed. But I found lots of hope also, and lots of very exciting alternatives. So I felt hearing these questions from people that to come up with some really simple rules of thumb on our eating choices today might be a useful contribution.
But it's interesting that you call the book "In Defense of Food."
Yeah, because food's under attack. Food is being undermined by, on the one hand, nutritional science, which, although very well-intentioned most of the time, is working hard to convince us that food is not really the relevant thing. It's nutrients. And they're trying to replace food with collections of nutrients, and at least in our minds. And then you have the food industry, on the other hand, which is not content to leave well enough alone and is always trying to process food, make it more complicated for, business imperative reasons. They need to process food to make money. And so they are attacking real whole foods, and they're taking simple products like yogurt and turning it into Go-Gurt portable yogurt tubes, stuff like that.
Now, is the focus on nutrition something that's particularly American? Are we seeing nutritionism in France?
Not the same way. Countries that have strong food cultures are less enchanted with, the message of scientists. And the whole idea that we should eat scientifically is a very American idea.
But it goes back a long time,
exactly.
Doesn't it?
Exactly. I thought it was a new thing, but in fact it goes back to the 19th century.
White foods,
and then you had the whole, John Harvey Kellogg and Horace Fletcher and all the food faddism around 1900. The idea that science should guide our eating goes back to the 1860s.
Is that because we don't really have a traditional cuisine, do you think?
I think that's right. I think that there's a vacuum, essentially. If you don't have a strong food culture, science will rush in. And also, we didn't have any kind of, since we were a nation of immigrants, there wasn't one food culture. So then you're looking for a common denominator, and science always seems objective and above it all. And it was also a way to, tell immigrants what to eat.
But why is keeping track of the nutrients in our food a problem?
Well, it's a problem if it gets in the way of real food. And it's a problem because the nutrients are not the same as the foods. And one of the interesting things about modern food science is we discover that, carrots, beta-carotene, carrots are good for you. Maybe it's the beta-carotene. But as soon as you take the nutrient out of the food and you turn it into a supplement, it no longer works.
So when they sell orange juice with calcium added, that calcium is useless?
It may or may not be useless. There's a lot of questions about whether you're getting, you can absorb calcium in that form. You're much better off getting calcium from, either milk or actually people don't realize green vegetables have plenty of calcium in it. We don't have to drink milk. Is that a better product? I would say not. I mean, I would say that you're better off, getting your vitamin C from orange juice, which is oranges are in the business of producing vitamin C. And this kind of, taking the fish oil and putting it in the milk and the yogurt is I think it's really a mistaken idea.
First of all, orange juice comes to us pasteurized. Does that kill the natural vitamin C?
No, I don't believe that it does.
Because I know vitamin C is really heat sensitive.
Yeah, and it may be that I don't think that it does, though. I think that the pasteurization isn't so hot. I mean, I know pasteurizing milk does diminish its nutritional quality and certain enzymes are broken up. And in general, if you can avoid pasteurizing food, you should. But, of course, then there are food safety risks.
Now you talked about food science, and we established that it goes back to the 19th century, and yet you say it's still in a primitive state.
Well, I think that's the key. I mean, there's nothing wrong with doing nutritional science, and someday we may get it right. But it only goes back 175 years or so, and they still basically don't understand either end of the food chain, which is to say, you know, what is going on in the soul of a carrot? It's a very complex system. There are thousands of nutrients. We've only identified a handful of them. And then on the other side of the food chain is the human body and the human digestive process and metabolism, which is also poorly understood.
So you say that food science is reductive, that thinking only about nutrients leaves out the possibility of food synergy.
And we are discovering that there are food synergies. I mean, that foods are more than the sum of their nutrients. There was a fascinating study last year on whole grains. And we know whole grains are good for you, and it prolongs life. People eat a lot of them, and various health outcomes are improved. But when you give people all what we think of as the good stuff in whole grains, the folic acid, the B vitamins, the omega-3s, it still isn't as good as the actual thing. So there's some third force going on in the whole grains or an unrecognized set of nutrients.
Well, what happens during the studies that are conducted by nutritional scientists? How do they conduct them?
They're handicapped by the fact that doing this research is very difficult. I mean, if you're studying the effect of a certain diet on a certain population, the first thing you need to know is what is that population actually eating? And the way that is ascertained is you give people a questionnaire every 3 months. Now, I filled out one of these questionnaires. They're called food frequency questionnaires. And as soon as you fill it out, you realize, oh, my God, all this data is bogus. You know, they're asking you, I mean, think about it, Leonard. In the last 3 months, how many times did you have a half a cup of broccoli? And when you did, what kind of fat was it prepared with? Was it margarine or butter, or was it olive oil? Now, you might be able to kind of guesstimate with the stuff you made at home, but we eat half our meals now out. Who knows what fat was used to prepare that? And indeed, we found that people lie about their food intake as much as anything except perhaps sex.
I don't know. I'm not going to talk about the sexual part, but I'm not sure whether I've eaten a half a cup of broccoli in a serving. I do know that I eat a fair number of florets, sometimes more, sometimes less.
Well, we can't even picture what a half a cup of broccoli looks like. It doesn't fit well into a half a cup. So all this data, in fact, we know they've done studies of the studies, and they found that food intake questionnaires are off on calories by 30%. Okay, either people are lying and underestimating how much they eat, or they just don't remember a whole lot of things they eat. And when I filled one out, my calorie intake came in at around 1,200 calories a day. And that just says I wasn't remembering a lot because I eat a lot more than I would vanish on 1,200 calories a day. So, you know,
and they can't use placebos in those studies.
That's exactly right. When you're testing a drug, you can give someone a placebo. But if you're testing broccoli, what's the placebo? You know, plastic broccoli? There's no such thing.
My guest is Michael Pollan, whose latest book is fifth is In Defense of Food, an Eater's Manifesto, and it's published by the Penguin Group. You say there are misconceptions about low-fat foods.
Well, you know, the great nutritional campaign for most of our lives, beginning in the 70s, has been to reduce fat intake. That was, you know, a real hallmark of American nutritionism thinking is that there's always an evil, satanic nutrient to be driven from the food supply, and there's always a blessed one to be, you know, that's going to fix everything. So for most of our lives, it's been fat. We've been in the lipophobic era of American history. And we came to the conclusion, beginning in the 50s, but culminating in the 70s, that fat was the problem with heart disease. Fat is what made you fat. And we worked very hard to transform the food supply, all very well intentioned. But as it turned out, the more we drove fat from the food supply and got on low-fat diets, the fatter we got. And so something wasn't working.
I've never had that problem. I've gotten fatter, but low-fat milk products don't have much taste, and so I don't bother with them. When people buy ground beef that's 95% lean, I always say, well, gee, there's not going to be any flavor to that hamburger you're going to make.
You know, fat is a delicious nutrient. And by the way, fat is an essential nutrient. You know, our brains are 60 or 70% fat. There are good fats and there are possibly some bad fats. And, you know, you're better off drinking or eating a small amount of a full fat product than lots of a low fat. And that's how we got into trouble. People felt if it was low fat, you could eat as much as you wanted. because it was magic. And so we the Snackwells phenomenon. There was this whole line of products that were low fat, but they were high in sugar, and they made people fat.
Does the same thing apply to the low-cal things, the no-sugar drinks and the like?
Well, one of the weirdnesses about low-cal drinks is children who switch to them don't lose weight very often. And it's not really understood, but even low-cal sodas are a problem for people. It may be that their taste buds are trained to require such a high level of sweetness, they get it other ways. I don't really know the mechanism, but it hasn't solved the problem as you might expect that it would.
I suspect they also are drinking a lot more of that soda, and there are other things in it.
There are preservatives in soda that we're now are implicated in some learning disabilities.
Now, you said that there are possibly fats that are not good for us. Aren't trans fats bad for us?
We have pretty good evidence that trans fats are bad, and we shouldn't eat them. But the thing to remember about trans fats is that they were invented to help get us off saturated fats, and this is why the low fat campaign was so misguided. I mean, they moved us onto margarine, telling us that butter was going to kill us. And they created trans fats to basically make vegetable oil solid at room temperature. They shoot it with hydrogen. And as it turned out, they replaced a possibly unhealthy fat, saturated fat, with a demonstrably lethal one, trans fats. So that was a disaster. It was a public health disaster for which, you know, these campaigners should owe us a direct apology.
Now, who's responsible for that, the scientists or people who were looking to make a buck? Because I remember reading about how the vegetable shortenings, for example, were really invented because they had all this excess stuff from, what was it, cottonseed?
Yeah. Well, when they figured out how to use cottonseed oil, we could start eating this fiber, cotton, and there was a lot of oil that they wanted to turn into something we could eat. The vegetable oil industry played a huge role in promoting margarine. The doctors and the medical researchers contributed to it, and the government, too. I mean, in 1977, the whole U.S. government threw its weight behind the low-fat hypothesis, the fat hypothesis, even before the science was really very good. It was pretty sketchy, actually, and there was real debate then whether fat was the problem or carbohydrates. And if you go back to that period, it's very interesting. It was a lively scientific debate. But once the government, in the form of George McGovern's set of dietary goals that he issued in 1977, it quieted all the dissenters from the lipid hypothesis. And everybody kind of got behind it. You know, it was a scientific paradigm, and scientific paradigms are very hard to challenge. And it's only in the last couple years that people are really beginning to realize that the lipid hypothesis has a lot of problems.
And George McGovern is one of the villains of this piece?
Well, I don't know if I'd call him a villain. He was trying to do good. He was trying to, you know, there was a lot of heart disease at the time, and he thought that telling people to eat less saturated fat, in fact, they thought through this, and they said, well, we're not absolutely sure, but how could it hurt to have people eat less fat? Well, it turned out it could hurt, because a low-fat diet, by definition, is a high-carbohydrate diet. And so we moved on to carbohydrates, and we, you know, the obesity epidemic dates from that period to today.
My guest is Michael Pollan, who's a professor of journalism at Berkeley, a longtime contributor to the New York Times Magazine, and the author of The Omnivore's Dilemma, The Botany of Desire, which were both New York Times bestsellers, and two other books before this fifth one called In Defense of Food, An Eater's Manifesto, which is published by Penguin. And we will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Michael Pollan, whose latest book is In Defense of Food, An Eater's Manifesto, published by the Penguin Press. You discuss the work of Weston Price in the 1930s. What did he discover about food and culture?
Well, Weston Price was part of this very interesting generation of medical workers who went out around the world to look at people eating traditional diets. You know, early in this...
He was a dentist, wasn't he?
He was a dentist, yes, from Ohio. And he noticed something very peculiar, which is the quality of people's teeth was going way downhill. He started practicing in the 1890s. And you know, when you think about it, isn't it weird how much dental care we need? I mean, we should have evolved not to need orthodontia or not to need cavities filled. And in fact, the fact that people's mouths are malformed and that they need this, all this kind of work, he felt was a result of bad nutrition before birth and after birth. And so he went looking for traditional peoples. And one of the first things he noticed is they didn't need dental work at all. They didn't need braces. They didn't need cavities filled. Sometimes they had like green slime over their teeth because they didn't brush their teeth, but the teeth underneath were fine. So he went looking for the secret of traditional diets. And what he found was quite striking, and it was corroborated by even people like Albert Schweitzer, who noticed the same thing, is that people who hadn't gotten onto the Western diet, this diet of highly refined grain, processed food, lots of meat, very little whole grain and vegetables, did not get chronic diseases by and large. No heart disease, no cancer, no diabetes, no obesity. And as soon as this diet came in, all these problems very quickly arose in a predictable order. And that they then decided to call those diseases the Western diseases that were caused by the Western diet. This was all very well known. And Weston Price wrote one of the important books about this. And
why has it been forgotten?
It's been forgotten because it was very much in the interest. Industrial agriculture, industrial food took over post-World War II. And the idea of looking back was, after World War II, was just out of fashion. And we decided we would use the medical system to solve the problems of the Western diseases rather than change our diet.
Now, is it refined foods that are the problem, or is it also the amount of meat that we eat? Because it's being pointed out that in countries like China, as there's more disposable income, people are demanding more meat in their diet.
And getting more chronic disease. Yeah.
And there's more obesity in China for the first time in quite a long time.
Here's the thing about the Western diet. We don't know exactly what in the Western diet is creating the problems. It may be red wheat, may be red meat, it may be processed grain, it may be free sugars, it may be lots of saturated fat. The fact is, you can point to other traditional diets like the Maasai warriors in Africa or the Inuit who eat meat and nothing else, and they're fine.
They all follow the Atkins diet.
More or less. Now, they're eating very different meat because the meat animals they're eating have a good diet, and our meat animals have a lousy diet. We just feed them corn and byproducts, antibiotics, and hormones. They would eat grass and bugs and things like that, so their meat is actually quite healthy. But, you know, you don't have to decide what in the Western diet is making people sick without realizing it is the Western diet and there is another way to eat.
When did we start refining foods and why?
Well, grain, we really got good at refining in the 1860s. We invented these steel and porcelain rollers that allowed us to completely get all the nutrients out of it, basically. We could crush it so fine, remove the bran and the germ, and white flour became this, you know, almost nutritionally worthless substance. But it was great because it would last forever. And the reason it would last forever is bacteria, fungus, mice had no interest in it because it was so nutritionally impoverished. So they were smarter than we were on that one. And as soon as that kind of grain came into the marketplace in the 1860s, 1870s, you have an epidemic of vitamin deficiencies in Europe. The fact is, it was possible to live by bread alone. Man could live by bread alone when bread was still a whole food.
But so it also seemed superior because it was more expensive and rich people could eat it.
It was prestigious.
And it was white and looked pure.
That's right. You know, white rice is more prestigious than brown rice. And one of the reasons is it was rich people's foods and now everybody could have it.
Now, when did corn become such a big problem? Corn, as I understand it, was something that is something that actually has very low nutritional value unless you do something to it. In Mesoamerica, they slaked it with lime,
right.
and they enriched it, and then they ate it with beans, and they wound up with a very nutritional diet.
Yeah, a complete set of proteins. If you eat it with beans and you slake the corn with lime, because there are various amino acids that are not available unless you do that. You know, that points to the wisdom of traditional diets. You know, long before science, people kind of figured this out, that if you eat foods in certain combinations and process them in certain ways, you can get all the nutrients you need. And science comes to this, you know, Johnny-come-lately. They kind of figure it out after the fact. It's like tomatoes and olive oil. You know, nice idea. We all like tomatoes and olive oil. Well, it turns out there's a very good nutritional reason for that. The olive oil makes the lycopene in the tomatoes more available to your body. And that points to, you know, one of the conclusions I came to, which is that there may be more wisdom about food in the traditional cuisines we already have than in the minds of all the nutritional scientists.
Now, in Europe, they'll tell you, the French especially, that the soil is a key factor in the quality of food and wine. They talk about terroir Is that true? Has our soil changed in this country?
Yeah. There's a whole body of research now looking at the quality of soil and how it affects the quality of food. One of the interesting things that I came across in doing the research was that since the 1950s, the nutritional quality of produce, as measured by the USDA, has diminished significantly, 20, 30, 40%, depending on the nutrient. People don't understand exactly why this is, but one theory is that we have simplified our soil since then because we do not feed the soil. We just give it chemical fertilizers. So we're only replacing those three nutrients that we know we're taking out, and we're ignoring all those kind of minor soil nutrients that plants may need for their health. And, you know, a simple soil leads to simple food. And this was understood, by the way, in the 30s by the pioneers of organic agriculture. Sir Albert Howard said, you know, we must look at the problem of health in soil, plants, animals, and man as one great subject.
Well, don't we pay our farmers to leave some land fallow?
Not right now. We've moved toward full-out corn production to feed our cars with ethanol. So there's very little land we're leaving fallow, and we're taking it out of fallow. No, we don't encourage farmers to rotate their crops or leave land fallow. We encourage farmers to grow as much as they possibly can with as many chemicals as they can possibly apply.
I guess it was different when I went to high school and they taught us that farmers rotate the crops.
It was a good idea then and it is a good idea now.
My guest is Michael Pollan, whose latest book is called In Defense of Food, An Eater's Manifesto. It is published by Penguin Press. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. A listener wants to know whether you're going to put out a cookbook.
No, I've taken a vow. I'm never going to do a diet book or a cookbook.
You recommend that we eat less. Isn't that obvious in a country where there's a serious obesity problem?
Yeah, it is. It is obvious. It's hard to do. And one of the things, you know, it's another area where culture may have more to teach us than anything else. So I looked at other traditions who deal with the abundance problem. And it's very interesting to see how the French navigate that issue, or traditionally navigated it. Small portions, no snacking, no seconds.
And Americans complain. They go to a French restaurant and they say, did you see how small those portions
were?
It was
puny. Well, you know, if you look at portions in American restaurants now, the plates are the size of the serving platters when I was a kid. It's supersizing has turned out to be very good economics, but disastrous for our waistlines.
And you suggest that we focus on plants. This is not a vegan diet.
Not at all. I say mostly plants. There's no nutritional reason to exclude meat from your diet, basically. It's good, nutritious food. However, we are eating huge quantities of meat. We eat it three times a day in this country, over 200 pounds per person per year. And that is more than people have historically eaten, unless you're a Maasai warrior, and we don't get the kind of exercise that a Maasai warrior gets.
But you also suggest we eat more leaves than seeds.
Yeah. The thing really missing from our diet, even on the plant side, is we've moved to a diet of seeds. Seeds in the form that we refine into breads and things like that, that we turn into high fructose corn syrup, corn kernels. And seeds are great. They're good storage organs for the winter, and that's why plants make them. But leaves are where you find the really key nutrients, and we don't eat nearly enough leaves.
The latest craze is omega-3 and omega-6, and you said earlier that they're good, but that we should get them in natural forms?
We should wherever possible. I mean, there are a lot of people who argue that fish oil supplements is not really an extraction of a single nutrient, that that is sort of like a whole food and that that's an exception to
those,
the rule of
those supplements. Pills.
Those pills. And there are, people who support doing that, and that may well be a good idea because most of us don't eat enough fish. And there is some reason to believe that as a country we have an omega-3 deficiency, and it's a really critical fatty acid for mental development. Omega-6s are another kind of essential fatty acid that we're getting far too much of, according to some researchers, and that the balance between the two is really what's key. And you see, omega-3s are produced in leaves, omega-6s in seeds. So as we move from leaves to seeds, we're getting too much of the latter. And mark my words, the next evil nutrient in America will be the omega-6 fatty acid. There will be products advertising their lack of omega-6. And once again, we will go overboard because you do need a certain amount of omega-6, but we're getting way too much.
But we're also caught in some horns of a dilemma here. We're told that we're fishing our oceans into extinction, that fish often have all sorts of other things in them, like mercury, and at the same time that we need to eat fish because they have omega-3.
Yeah, and I think that that's it's interesting. The kind of nutritional guidance I'm offering people, I noticed at some point that in every case, what I was advising people to eat whole foods from, you know, from good soils, well-grown, local, was the message was good for your health and equally good for the environment. The one exception was we do need to eat more fish, and if we do, the fisheries will collapse. The fact is that there aren't enough fish for all of us, and we have to, you know, be careful on what kinds of fish we eat. On the other hand, some of the ones that are richest in omega-3 are these, you know, these little oily ones, you know, like sardines and anchovies and mackerel and those kind of things. And those are still in abundance, and they don't have the problem with mercury that the big predator fish do, like swordfish. So, you know, we have to be careful that we eat from sustainable fisheries. But people don't realize how much omega-3 you can get from other places. Eating leafy greens gives you omega-3s. Eating, you know, well-grown grass-fed meat has plenty of omega-3s in it, too.
And there is a seed, flax seed.
There is a seed, yes. That's right. That's the one that's got a lot of omega-3. And flaxseed oil is another good place to get it. So you can get omega-3s without... You know, the fish are getting them from plants, too. The fish get it from algae. So we can get it from green plants as well.
Now, you said earlier that humans survive and thrive on many different types of diets. Can't we thrive and survive on the Western diet?
Well, you know, it appears to be the one diet... yet invented by mankind.
That's because we're superior to everybody else.
That we are poorly adapted to. It's kind of remarkable that that this has been our great achievement as a civilization, to figure out a way to feed ourselves that kills us. But that is, in effect, what we're doing. And it is true. All the traditional diets are fine. And, you know, when I first started advising that, people would say to me, but what about the diet of your ancestors, Eastern European Jewish? You know, all that chicken fat and goose fat and those organs. And I mentioned this to a researcher, a doctor, and she said, well, why do you assume that fat was so bad? Yes, there's saturated fat, but it's not the world's greatest evil. But along with that saturated fat, that chicken or that goose or duck was running around eating grass and bugs, had a very healthy diet, and indeed that fat was probably a whole lot better than the vegetable oils on the market. And so even the Eastern European Jewish diet, eaten in moderation, is a good diet. And you know, my grandparents lived into their 90s.
Well, there were a lot of farms in the stables.
There were. And animals animals had better diets then, I think, is the key. And even, you know, even animals that eat detritus actually ate better than our animals do today.
You give tips at the end of the book, like a suggestion to eat at a table. How does that affect the way we eat?
Well, what I'm trying to get at with that is, you know, Americans snack way too much. If you want to look at, you know, the extra calories we've been eating since 1980, 300 extra since 1980 for most of us, most of that comes in the form of snacks. We're eating in front of the TV. We're eating in the car. A fifth of our meals we're eating in the car. The industry has colonized every part of the day except while we're asleep. And, you know, with this Ambien thing, with people getting up to raid the refrigerator, they may have even conquered sleep.
On the other hand, there are a lot of people who are very open to this message, have already been open to this kind of message. And then we wind up with the debates over whether organic foods are really all that much better for us, whether we should only eat locally, considering the fact that sometimes it's actually more fuel efficient or better, or the lamb that we get from New Zealand might be better in other ways because they graze on grass as opposed to the sheep that might be only 50 miles away but are being fed corn. So any really easy answers here?
You know, yeah, eat food, not too much, mostly plants, you know.
We're back to that.
When you can, you know, local generally is better because it's fresher. There are certainly exceptions, and fresher food is more nutritious. Organic, you know, on balance is better. The food may be slightly more nutritious, but, you know, it's much better for the environment. Our health, you know, we cannot separate our health from the health of the land and the health of the water and the health of the air. And organic addresses all those imperfectly, there's no question. But you can really get lost in the weeds of local versus organic and organic versus conventional. And if you're eating whole foods, you know, yeah, the first step is to eat the whole foods. The next step is, well, then give a little thought to its provenance. Where did it come from? Who grew it? How did they grow it? But don't drive yourself crazy. I mean, you know, we're suffering from what some doctors call orthorexia, you know, this unhealthy obsession with healthy eating. Relaxing about our food is going to be good for our health, too.
Haven't some people accused you of elitism? How do you answer them?
You know, this whole movement to reform our food system is accused of elitism. And the reason for that is that the fact is to eat healthily in this country costs more money. and takes more time. You know, as an indictment of the movement, I don't know exactly how to address that except to say that, you know, the reason that it costs more money is that we have a political system that supports the least healthy food in the supermarket. It's the calories of added fat and added sweet sugar in the form of high fructose corn syrup that we subsidize as a society. So naturally, the junk food is cheaper than the healthy food. We have to change the policies. And the other point about elitism is, you know, there are a great many movements in American history that began as elite movements. You know, look at women's suffrage, look at abolition, look at the environmental movement. People with time and money often begin these changes, and other people pick up the cause.
This book is different in style from your previous books. It's a lot more opinionated.
It is. It's a manifesto. And, you know, eat food, not too much, mostly plants may not sound like Workers of the World Unite. But if people truly began to eat this way, we would see radical changes in our food system and then radical changes in our health.
People who read the last book and remember the chapter on butchering a cow might be surprised that you're saying eat mostly plants.
Well, if you butchered a boar, you're less likely to eat a lot of meat. you know, again, I use a word like mostly to say let's not be absolutist about this. You know, it's not all or nothing. We tend to cast these food issues in these Manichaean terms of good and evil, and it's not like that. You know, that a little bit of just about any food is going to be all right. It's really getting the big picture right.
Michael Pollan's latest book is called In Defense of Food, An Eater's Manifesto, published by the Penguin Press. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Thank you, Leonard. It's great to be back.